It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
Environmentalists responded positively to President Obama's climate speech yesterday, but what role is Congress going to play in actually enacting any policy? It's our weekly look at Congress with Paul Singer.
But first, a judge dismissed a lawsuit today that aimed to redesign election ballots in Waukesha County before the November 4th election.
Republican legislative leaders filed the lawsuit against the state's Government Accountability Board, alleging that it was confusing and could influence the outcome of the election by giving too much prominence to Democrats.
Wisconsin Public Radio state government reporter Sean Johnson was at the hearing today in Waukesha, and he's with us now to get caught up on what happened. Sean, thanks for stopping back again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Republican legislative leaders had an issue with the model ballot in Waukesha County. What were their concerns there?
So what they said was that there wasn't enough differentiating the name of an office on the ballot from the first candidate for that office. And their concern was that if you, wasn't going to affect anybody running for governor, for example, but if you go on down the ballot to lesser known races, say for the state assembly, for example, that a voter would look at those offices and potentially think that there was only one candidate running for those offices and that they might not vote in those races. In Wisconsin, because Democrats won the presidential race here in 2012, state law says that they are listed first. Their candidates are listed first on the ballot in the next election. And so in this situation, left a ballot where Republicans said, essentially it was going to give Democrats an unfair advantage.
Now, is this an issue that is specific to Waukesha County's ballots, or is this something that was statewide and would have popped up in other places on ballots?
This is something that was statewide. This is something that was filed in Waukesha County because of a state law that Republicans passed that lets lawsuits against the state be filed in any Wisconsin county. So traditionally in the past, these would be filed in Dane County, the seat of state government. But under this new law, Republicans are able to challenge, the Government Accountability Board in this instance anywhere. And so they chose to challenge the GAB in Republican-friendly Waukesha County. They did have success there in court challenges, on election-related challenges in 2012 during the recalls. But today, not so much. I mean, the judge was made pretty quick work of their challenge there. Heard about 25 minutes of arguments. Read a couple of cases that one of the lawyers mentioned during those arguments and came back and ruled.
Wow. So 25 minutes it only took. What was the ultimate decision or why was it made?
Yeah. So it was about an hour after arguments started that the judge came back and said he was dismissing the case. Not necessarily the most exciting reasons for why he dismissed it, but he said, number one, that the campaign committees of Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald did not have standing to sue, that the committees had not been harmed. There'd been no injury. And so when you haven't been harmed, when you haven't been injured, you don't have access to the court system in a case like this. The other thing that he mentioned was that statutes require a challenge like this against the Government Accountability Board to first be filed formally with the Government Accountability Board. So Voss and Fitzgerald did not take that step. They went straight to the courtroom. The judge said state law basically just says you can't do that.
And what has response from the Government Accountability Board been so far to this dismissal?
They said it was the opinion that they were hoping for. And, Kevin Kennedy, the director of the Government Accountability Board, said you always have some type of controversy with ballots in any election. But, the idea that this was going to give some kind of a partisan advantage, he had referred to previously as absurd. One other thing that came up during arguments is that when the Government Accountability Board creates these model ballots as a template for clerks to use all over Wisconsin, clerks don't necessarily follow suit. I mean, they don't have to. And in practice, they're not doing it. In this case, I mean, there are a number of counties with Democratic county clerks who said, we're not going to use the model ballots from the Government Accountability Board. We're going to use something else. It might be subtly different, but they have that autonomy to do something a little bit different than the state allows. And that is something that the judge noted before he issued his ruling in today's case.
Now, briefly, before we move on, I understand the judge also said that a voter should have been the one to bring this suit to the courts, not these committees. Is that likely to happen? Or is that something that would also have to happen after the election?
I don't know. I mean, the attorney for the Republican legislative leaders was asked about that, whether we would see a follow-up suit by a voter. And he just didn't have an answer for that. I suppose it, you know, that might hinge on how important Republicans think this issue really is. You know, they've sort of made the Government Accountability Board a whipping boy in some of these cases where they really have gone after the board. They use it to kind of drum up support among their base. The GAB has been a frequent target of theirs. So, you know, it could have been some political motivation behind filing this suit as well.
So moving on to the very busy Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, we're still waiting for word about whether or not they're going to take up a case against Wisconsin's voter ID law with a full panel. What do you think is likely to happen there?
Yeah, so we don't know. I mean, we know that a three-judge panel a couple weeks ago heard Wisconsin's voter ID challenge, which had halted voter ID, you know, for a couple years, and just hours later issued an order that reinstated the law. So plaintiffs for the ACLU and other groups that wanted to block the case have asked the full Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals to hear the case en banc, you know, so you'd have every judge at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals ruling on the case. They say that you can't reinstate voter ID this close to an election. So the response by the state has been, look, voter ID is happening. If you were to put the brakes on it again, the verb that they used is you'd be ping-ponging state election officials and voters. So it's really up to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. A majority of the judges there would need to vote to take the case. We don't know if that'll happen.
And what impact do you see if on voters and election officials if the voter ID issue remains intact between now and Election Day?
I think as far as turnout goes, definitely remains to be seen. It's a lot closer to the election to implement this law than the Government Accountability Board or clerks had hoped. They say they're up to the challenge, but you know, one of the initial difficulties we've seen with that is there have been almost 12,000 absentee ballots sent out without instructions that say you have to include some kind of a photo ID. What do you do with those ballots? Hundreds, at least, were already sent back. In other words, they were voted without sending in a photo ID. You know, that's if it's a close election, that's the type of stuff that could end up in a courtroom.
Now, Sean, before we let you go, there was some breaking news just moments before the show. We got word that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals repealed the injunction by Judge Randa stopping the John Doe investigation. So what does this mean and where are we now?
Yes, it's been very busy at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. What that means is that the John Doe investigation, John Doe 2, as it's been called, is essentially back on. It had been halted by a federal judge in Wisconsin, Judge Rudolph Randa. He agreed with conservative groups that it was a violation of their First Amendment rights. You know, I've got a heavy opinion here from the Court of Appeals, haven't had a chance to go through it extensively, but they seem to be getting at what they said in oral arguments, and that is that it's not the place of a federal judge to get into the state court's business in this way and to issue an injunction blocking a state court proceeding. You know, those are some of the first words written here by Judge Frank Easterbrook, who wrote the opinion. And so what this means is that the federal court systems stop to this investigation, that this John Doe investigation in the state court system has now been lifted.
So where does it go then? Back to the state court?
This thing has so many tentacles. Investigators have their own challenges in state court and, you know, and getting some of the evidence that they obtained through subpoenas to be included as part of the record. They had a state court judge rule that those subpoenas were too broad. And I think it may come down to an interpretation of state statute when it comes to coordination between campaigns like Governor Scott Walker's and these conservative groups. But one of those branches of this investigation that took it off into the federal court system, it would appear through this ruling that argument has been closed, although, of course, these conservative groups could appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, Sean, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for coming on.
All right. Thank you.
We've been talking to Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio state government reporter, getting us caught up on a few issues in the courts today. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
The United States launched its first round of airstrikes against ISIS in Syria on Monday, stirring up more dissatisfaction among those who think a vote in Congress is needed to authorize military force.
And some environmentalists are applauding President Obama's climate speech at the UN yesterday. But what role is Congress playing in any of the policy he's seeking internationally?
Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. It's good to have you on, Paul.
Nice to be here. How are you?
Good, thanks. So let's start with the American airstrikes against Syria, which began on Monday. Pentagon spokesperson said this is only the beginning, and there have been calls in Congress for a vote to authorize military force. Now, this is, you know, to say the least, sort of a sticky subject for Congress right now at this particular junction in time. Where do you think we are with that possibly happening before the elections?
Well, you know, there's three kind of relevant things here. The first is that Congress voted a couple of weeks ago to approve the arming and training of Syrian rebel groups. So that was the first opportunity for Congress to really get on the record endorsing a public engagement of Syrian fighters by the U.S. military. They've been doing some of this kind of clandestinely in the past. But that authorization expires the second week of December. So at that juncture, Congress is going to have to vote on something. That also is tied to the year-long funding bill for the federal government. And to avoid a federal government shutdown, they'll have to extend the funding for federal agencies also on that same bill, middle of December. So there's a sort of a must-pass bill with an already passed provision on it. But both of those provisions give an opportunity for Congress to mess around a little bit. They could reconsider whether or not they want to vote again on the authorization to train and supply. They could be dealing with a funding request of some sort for the administration on this action. And then there's a third question of a standalone authorization of military force in Syria. That's the toughest one. Because at that point, you are essentially giving the president the authority to conduct a war. And that makes some folks in Congress very, very, very nervous.
Well, those first things you outlined sound like they could all be put off until after Election Day. But that authorization of military force specific to Syria, and if they don't do it now, it's maybe a weird argument to make not to do it now, but to do it 3 months after it started. Is there any kind of pressure to make something happen before November?
Nope. Nobody's coming back to vote on that. I can almost assure you, Congress is out of session. They have no intention to come back. I would be stunned if for some reason they decided to come back and have this vote before November 4th. Now, of course, I've been surprised before, but but then we get to the problem you're raising there, Rob, which is that, well, what's the point of voting to authorize military force if we've been using military force in the country for the past 6 weeks? You know, it becomes kind of a moot point. Part of this is, I think, going to depend on how this battle goes. I mean, if this becomes a bigger and bigger and bigger campaign over a period of time, and particularly if it comes to the issue of having Americans on the ground or killed, God forbid, in action on the ground, that's when Congress is more likely to swing into action.
And how much does this have to do with the fact that the elections are coming up, the midterms, and that this is a muddy situation?
Oh, almost everything has to do with the elections coming up. I mean, I think that's part of the issue, right? And I also give these guys a certain amount of credit. I mean, it's early enough in this campaign. It's a little unclear to everybody what's happening, what's going to happen, what the outcomes are going to be, what the end point is, what the long game is, what the long view is for the United States. I think that for Congress, voting on an authorization of military force that might be in effect for many years is a little bit of a dicey situation because they're not sure what they're buying. They don't know exactly what this war is going to look like. And you can tell even now, okay, we've got airstrikes going on. We're not sure how many of them are Americans. We don't know how many of them are other nations who are conducting airstrikes on our behalf. It's just, I think there is a serious concern amongst members of Congress about not wanting to get out ahead of this train, except, of course, in a couple of cases. You know, I think the John McCains of the world, the hawks who really believe that the military might of the United States is our most important role in this part of the world. Easier for someone like McCain to vote on this. Harder for somebody who might be running for re-election or running for president in 2 years.
Well, moving on to another issue on the world stage, President Obama made a speech at the UN yesterday calling on the world to be more ambitious about stemming climate change, trying to put pressure on China to play a bigger role. So when President Obama makes speeches like that, that pitched kind of to an international audience, how much do they matter domestically and they have any relationship to what Congress might vote on, probably not soon, but say in the next year?
Yeah, that, you know, Obama is making an appeal that I think you fully understand, right? There's not a lot the Americans can do to fight climate change by ourselves. Some of the heaviest emissions that are contributing to climate change are taking place overseas. Some of what the United States is trying to do is to help economic development in those countries in a way that is more sustainable and more emissions friendly, as it were. But almost none of that involves Congress, and Congress has made it very, very clear they don't want to do a whole lot on environmental issues. And you've seen, you know, if any of your listeners watched Jon Stewart and The Daily Show, they saw a funny little takeout a couple of nights ago on the House Science Committee that was basically complaining a lot about any kind of effort to regulate greenhouse gases or even to address climate change. So I wouldn't expect Congress to vote on much, and I wouldn't expect the president's speech at the UN to encourage or to push Congress to do much. I mean, honestly, and I mean this in, you know, with no criticism of the president, the fact of the matter is that this UN trip is going to be remembered for what he said about war in Syria, not what he said about climate change. So that's the topic that's going to come home, and particularly to Congress, is going to be war in Syria. For the near foreseeable future, I don't expect climate change to be a point of conversation, particularly if the Republicans win the Senate next year.
And, you know, on another point there, does the president have the credibility to be making a speech like this? Reportedly last year, India, China, and the United States were among the top carbon emitters.
Right. Well, I mean, he can say a lot of things about things we want to do, things we'd like to do, things we should do. My recollection is, and I'm not a climate change expert by any stretch of imagination, my recollection is we could never get the U.S. Congress to ratify treaties, you know, that would bind us to any of these targets. So, you know, it's hard for the United States in general to demand that other people cut their emissions when, as you said, we are not the best actors on our own front. But on the other hand, you know, Obama is pushing regulations to ratchet down emissions from power plants, one of the biggest sources here in the United States. So it's not like we are not taking the challenge seriously at some level. Whether that's enough to convince international partners to play along, I don't know.
Lastly, before I let you go, Paul, I know you at USA Today are keeping track of the role women are playing nationally in the race for the Senate. Yes. To what extent is the future of the Senate in the hands of women in office?
Well, it's, you know, it's both in the hands of women in office, and in some cases, I think it would be very clearly, and women voters are going to be very, very key in some of these races. You know, if the Democrats can motivate women to vote for Michelle Nunn in Georgia, for instance, that's a seat that the Democrats think might be in play, a Republican seat that might be in play. Obviously, if the Democrats are going to still have control of the U.S. Senate next year, it's going to be because a woman named Mary Landrieu managed to survive her re-election bid in Louisiana. It might be because a woman named Jean Shaheen survived her re-election bid in New Hampshire. You know, there are a lot of women candidates that the Democrats are relying on. Kay Hagan in North Carolina, another one, women incumbents who Democrats are relying on to save their majority. Now, also a couple of women Republicans running that will be interesting. Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia is almost certain to be the next senator from West Virginia. She's a Republican.
Paul, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great day.
You too. That's USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us each week at this time to talk about the latest news from Congress. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, our guest says that veterans make particularly good entrepreneurs, which is why veterans from around the region are meeting in Madison this weekend to work on growing their ideas into businesses.
First, we take a look at the political evolution of one of the most powerful politicians on Capitol Hill, Senate Minority Leader, maybe Majority Leader someday soon, Mitch McConnell.
Our next guest says in order to understand the transformation of Washington and American politics over the last few decades, we have to understand Mitch McConnell, Republican senator from Kentucky. He argues that McConnell embodies the transformation of the Republican Party and of politics in general in this country.
He's here to make that argument now. Alec McGillis joins us from the WYPR studios in Baltimore. He's senior editor at The New Republic and the author of The Cynic, The Political Education of Mitch McConnell. Alec, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, what is it about Mitch McConnell that grabbed you, made you want to write about him?
It is an unusual subject to take on. I think a lot of people don't think of Mitch McConnell as the most scintillating figure in politics, which was actually something I think has worked to his advantage over the years, that he hasn't gotten all that much scrutiny because he's so colorless, really, and kind of bland and inscrutable that we don't really look at him that much. But I decided that it was time to take him on in a big way, in a deep way, because to me, he represents two things better than just about anyone else in Washington. One is the transformation of the Republican Party over the past 30 years or so, from a party that was very, very ideologically diverse and regionally diverse, demographically diverse, to a party that is today much more orthodox in a whole lot of ways and homogenous in a whole lot of ways. The other element for me of the appeal in looking closely at McConnell is that he really, to me, represents a bipartisan trend in Washington, which I've come to really kind of deplore over my years covering Washington, which is just this mindset of the permanent campaign, where everything that matters is the next election, the next cycle, and winning that next cycle more than what you actually do when you get to Washington.
Let's go back to the start of his political career. As he was running for office for the first time, he was viewed as uncharismatic, not a natural politician by his own staff and people, as I understand it.
That's right. He was a very very clumsy candidate. He was not a natural for this game. And he knew that, to his credit. He knew that. He was very self-aware about that. And so he tried very hard to get better. And he would do multiple takes for his ads, his campaign ads, because he was just not a very, natural actor in the ads. And he was very, very happy when the crew would finally tell him, "Hey, Mitch, you did well." They actually had a nickname for him. Behind his back, they called him "Love Me, Love Me," because he was so eager for their approval. He got a little better over the years, as a candidate. But one reason that he's been so adamant about protecting the role of money in politics and trying to prevent new regulations on campaign spending and giving is that he came to realize that he really needed money for his races, needed to heavily outspend the opposition because he wasn't at all a natural candidate on the stump.
And some candidates over the years, politicians have bemoaned the fact that they have to spend a lot of time fundraising. Not so Mitch McConnell?
No, Mitch McConnell loves fundraising. It's remarkable. His Republican colleagues in on the Hill told me that they just would marvel at him, just how much he enjoyed doing it. One time there was a moment where he went to a house to some potential donors he was told might be willing to give to him, and he realized he'd come to the wrong house, and he simply stayed and got the people whose house he'd come to give to him. He's very opportunistic that way. He really enjoys it. He has no compunction about asking for money at all.
Well, he came of political age at a time when Barry Goldwater was shaking up the Republican Party with a more strongly conservative view, but there was still a strong liberal Republican tradition in the country. Where did he fall in the early part of his career?
Well, this is the amazing thing. He fell very much at the liberal end of the Republican Party spectrum. There was this big war going on in the Republican Party in the early 60s with Goldwater and his folks on one side, and a pretty strong moderate liberal contingent still on the other side. And Mitch very much lined up with the moderates. His great hero was a Kentucky senator called John Sherman Cooper, who he went to work for him briefly on the Hill and really held him up as his ideal. John Sherman Cooper opposed the Vietnam War very strenuously and also very strongly supported civil rights and helped push through the Civil Rights Bill. And both of those positions were not necessarily popular in Kentucky. He did it anyway. And Mitch said that he admired him greatly for that. He was such a moderate back then that he got very excited reading an essay that had been written by a leading moderate Republican in Playboy. So apparently Mitch McConnell was reading Playboy for the articles. He actually was doing that. And he fired off a very enthusiastic letter to this gentleman saying how much he agreed with him about the importance of moderation.
And in at least one election, McConnell got endorsements from the AFL-CIO?
Exactly. He got in his first race for office in 1977, running for the county executive job in Louisville, in the biggest county, Jefferson County, the biggest county in Kentucky. He won partly because he got a lot of the sort of liberal local establishment on his side, including the newspaper editorial board and the AFL-CIO. He got them to support him by saying that he would support public employee collective bargaining, which is a topic of some relevance to Wisconsinites know about that. So here you have a Republican supporting public employee collective bargaining. He went to the bowling alley to sort of woo the head of the AFL-CIO, got their endorsement, and then went on to show his moderation even more in the next couple of years by being a very strong ally of the abortion rights advocates in Louisville. He was very effective at snuffing out abortion rights bills, anti-abortion bills that came into his office as county executive.
So following up on one of those two big themes you mentioned, how did Mitch McConnell move from there to being generally viewed as a solid conservative along with the rest of his party?
Well, what basically happened, and he's been pretty candid about this over the years, he just decided that it was going to be easier for him to win and going forward if he shifted way to the right. He saw where Kentucky and the South were going politically. He saw where the Republican Party was going, and he just decided that he needed to get on that bus. The key moment, if there was one, was in 1984 when he ran for the Senate for the first time. He barely won that Senate race against an incumbent sort of conservative Southern Democrat. Meanwhile, Ronald Reagan won Kentucky that year by 250,000 votes. Mitch won by just 5,000 or so. And Mitch looks at this and he thinks, gosh, I don't ever want to come that close to losing again. If I want to win more easily in the future in this state, I clearly need to be more like Ronald Reagan. He had not supported Ronald Reagan either in 76 or 1980 in his primaries. But he decided that I need to make myself more like Ronald Reagan and more like where this party's heading.
And some of the things you just touched on hit that other theme. Mitch McConnell is a politician who wants to win, like any politician, but you say he pushed the envelope in ways that people weren't necessarily doing at the time.
That's true. He pushed the envelope in a couple of ways. He was... again, very aggressive on the fundraising front, and then later years very aggressive in trying to keep the status quo laws in place to allow that kind of fundraising to continue, or even to change the laws to make it even more, to make it even looser, the fundraising. He was also very aggressive when it came to negative campaigning, which is, again, nothing that, you know, he's hardly the only one who's engaged in that. But in Kentucky, this was sort of a new thing, the level to which he took it. The most sort of startling example was in 1990, in his first race for reelection. He had a pretty tough race against a very highly respected local physician who had, you know, worked at a clinic, volunteered at a clinic in eastern Kentucky years ago, then set up another clinic in the African-American West End of Louisville, had even, you know, served overseas in Vietnam as a doctor, went on to become mayor of Louisville. So they ran against each other in 90, close race. Mitch was too close for comfort. In the last couple weeks of the race, Mitch's campaign leaked to the press that this doctor had prescribed himself sleeping pills using an expired physician ID number, basically, and it got blown up into this big thing. They ran these unbelievably rough ads made by Roger Ailes, and Mitch pulled out that race. After he won that race, he proudly declared that it was the best campaign run in America that year.
And he, a lot of politicians set their sights. The big prize is maybe someday being president. It seems like Mitch McConnell, really, the Senate is his ambition, and maybe majority leader would be the pinnacle of that for him.
Exactly. He's never been one of those senators. You know, the joke is that everyone in the Senate wants to be president, but not Mitch McConnell. He's like Harry Reid in that regard, where he just so loves this institution and so wants nothing more than to climb to the pinnacle of the institution. The question is what he actually wants to do when he gets there, if there's been any goal all along other than just getting there.
We're talking to political reporter Alec McGillis about how the political evolution of Senator Mitch McConnell, he says, embodies the changes in the Republican Party, American politics too, for that matter, at large.
And we're taking your calls. Do you think the Republican Party has changed in the last few decades? How would you characterize that change? And why do you think there have been so many shifts in American politics? How do you see it playing out in Wisconsin? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@wpr.org.
We'll pick up the discussion, take your calls after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now with political reporter Alec McGillis about how the political transformation of Republican Senator Mitch McConnell symbolizes larger changes in American politics.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts or questions about Mitch McConnell's career? How have you seen the Republican Party change over the last few decades? And how have you seen American politics change? So for the better or for the worse? And any lessons here from Wisconsin? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org. I have a comment from Lynn in Rockdale who asks, what do you think of Mitch McConnell's comments after Obama won the presidency that he was going to make sure Obama was a one-term president? What do you make of McConnell's constant unwillingness to cooperate with the president? Alec, I think that quote was actually during the 2010 midterm elections. But still, what do you make of that comment?
That's a very good question. I get at the comment in my book. There's two ways of looking at that comment. One is that Mitch McConnell just had this real animus ad hominem feeling against Barack Obama from the get-go, and just wanted to see him, you know, just to see him laid low. But I think there's a more, in a way, more charitable interpretation, which fits into the theme I was talking about before, which is that Mitch McConnell, above all, just really wants to win the next cycle. That's how he's always been, and that's how he'll always be. And so when he said in late 2010, it was right before the midterm, maybe just after it, it was clear that the Republicans were going to be in the majority. And someone asked him, what are you going to do with this new power? What's your goal for these next couple of years? And he said, well, our number one goal is to keep Obama from getting reelected. And it sounded terrible and awful and harsh, but in some ways, that is just how he's always thought. Of course, your goal in Washington is to win the next cycle. And for the Republicans in 2010, winning the next cycle meant Barack Obama losing in 2012. That's just how he thinks. There was a good profile of McConnell just a couple weeks ago in the Times magazine where he did speak to that reporter. He refused to speak to me for my book, but he spoke to that reporter, and the one thing he kept saying to the reporter was, hey, I'm 8-0, meaning that has 8 wins and 0 losses in his elections. And it really was like talking to a middle relief pitcher in baseball about his record for the year.
Well, you said earlier this is something that Mitch McConnell is not alone on. You are worried, Alec, about a bipartisan trend of focusing more attention after you get elected on the next elections instead of governing. Is this really government-wide these days?
Yes, it's gotten much worse. I mean, to me, Mitch McConnell still embodies that tendency more than anyone. But it's you see more and more of it, and it has various causes. One of the causes, of course, is just the incredible cost of running for office now, in part because regulations that might reform our finance system have been blocked by people like Mitch McConnell. But because it costs so much to run, you really do have to start raising money as soon as you come to Washington for your next race. So you're constantly sort of focused on your next race in that regard. I think the press has a role, definitely. I mean, the press just loves there's nothing easier or more fun for the press than thinking about the next cycle, because you don't have to sort of focus on the actual governing or policy that's going on in Washington. You can just think about, oh, well, what are going to be the tough races next time around? Who's vulnerable? Who's not? That kind of thing. And then in a way, I think it also has to do with Washington is getting more sealed off from the rest of the country and into this sort of bubble where you have these politicians who desperately don't want to have to leave it. They just want to stay for good. And like people like Mitch McConnell, who's now been there for really virtually his entire adult life. It's quite remarkable.
I'm going to a caller now. We've got Judy on the line in Milwaukee. Judy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am curious about the statement that Mitch McConnell decided he wanted to be reelected. He made decisions based on wanting to be reelected as opposed to core beliefs or whatever you want to call it. Did he say that?
He did not say it in those explicit terms that you just laid out, but he's been quite candid about his evolution and that he saw what was happening in the 80s. He saw how popular Ronald Reagan had been. He's been very candid in a couple. There's a historian in Kentucky, a retired historian, who McConnell gives annual oral history interviews to. He's done this for years. It's a sign of sort of how sort of historically significant he thinks that he is, that he's been giving these interviews to a historian. And in those interviews, and then also in an authorized biography that he helped put out a couple years ago, he was remarkably candid about his evolution and that it was basically him seeing where the winds were blowing and that he better get on the other side of the line.
Now, what's he like as a leader of Republicans in the Senate?
Well, it's been tricky for him, of course, because he's had to deal with this Tea Party insurgency, or however you want to describe that. And he's been privately very scornful of a lot of these folks, you know, that they don't know how Washington works and they come here thinking they can throw the whole thing over. But of course, on the surface, he's been very accommodating because he wants to keep them on his side. Just the way after Rand Paul became elected in Kentucky in 2010, McConnell moved very quickly to get on his good side as well. As a leader of the Republicans, he's done a lot to appease them, and I would argue that he's actually done quite a bit to rev them up further, because by being so obstructionist in the Senate and refusing to cooperate or work with negotiate with Obama on stuff, he's made it necessary for the Democrats to push through a lot of stuff like the health care bill on a party line vote instead of giving up a couple Republican votes in exchange for some policy concessions from the Democrats. And because Democrats push things through on the party line vote, that only further inflames folks on the Tea Party end of things. And so, in a sense, he's actually, I would argue, sort of helped gin up that movement.
And that movement had a primary challenge to him this year, which he survived. Was he at risk at any point because of that?
Well, he was at risk to some degree just because he's just the way he's at risk to some degree now, because he is so remarkably unpopular in Kentucky. It's really odd to think about the fact that you have someone who's sort of leading the conservative vanguard in Washington, holding the line against Obama, in a state that doesn't like Obama, a state that's gotten quite red over the years, and yet his approval ratings are very low in Kentucky. He's built up none of that sort of affection that you often see from veteran politicians in their states, sort of well of sympathy. He just doesn't have that. So he was vulnerable to some extent. The candidate who ran against him was flawed, and Mitch went all out in trying to sort of outflank him to the right. I mean, he even went so far as to hire Rand Paul's former campaign manager and family member to run his campaign to sort of help keep the Tea Party people in the McConnell fold.
Why is it? Why doesn't he have that sense of support? Does it go back to the beginning of his political career where he's just not a natural politician?
I think it does. And I think that a lot of Kentuckians have seen enough of him over the years to sort of figure him out. And they sort of know what he's up to, that he's there mainly in Washington to climb that ladder and to accrue his own, to build up his own station, his own stature. That said, they are also reluctant to cut him loose because they like the fact that their own senator is so senior in Washington and so powerful. Back in the day when we had earmarks, it meant getting a lot of earmarks. And now it just means having sort of just knowing that your guy's at the table. And for a state like Kentucky that ranks low on a lot of, you know, metrics of income and what have you, is often, you know, unfairly looked down upon. It's nice to have your guy at the table at the end of the day.
As we wrap up, Alec, you mentioned his place in history. I mean, come November, he might be Senate Majority Leader. He might be unemployed. Either way, as of now, is he a significant figure in American political history?
I do believe he is, not so much for what he's accomplished, because it would be hard to find specific things that he's accomplished beyond the campaign finance issue. But he's significant for sort of what he represents, and for how he embodies this. He really, better than anyone else, I think he embodies this with what has happened to the grand old party in these 30 years and what has happened to the political culture in Washington.
Alec, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Alec MacGillis. He's senior editor at The New Republic. He was with us to talk about his new ebook. It's called The Cynic, The Political Education of Mitch McConnell, talking about what the Kentucky senator, the current Senate Majority Leader, tells us about the history of the Republican Party and American politics and the future of those as well.